My name is Glenn Garrismill. I'm National Coordinator of Lutheran Peace Fellowship. For the last 3.5 years, I've spent much of my life working in issues that relate to peace and justice. You heard some stories from the 14 years I spent working with the elderly in New York City and Oakland, and before that with the farm workers and with peace, and really fundamentally the initial involvement with civil rights kind of activity, and since then more peace and international security stuff and so forth. What I thought I would do for this session is kind of cobble together three or four of my favorite stories, three or four of the most inspiring things that I've encountered, particularly in the last 3 years. And there'll be some activities that we'll do for a couple of them, and others will be, I'll hand out something for you to check out and so forth, and we'll kind of take it from there. How many of you have ever felt or heard someone say, you know, with a country as big as ours and the problems as big as ours, you really can't make a difference? Well, the story I thought I would start with is the chemical weapons ban. I didn't even finish writing it up here. It was passed after 20 years of work on the United Nations level and in Congress and so forth. I mean, I must have a stack of stuff 3 feet high that I've collected over the years of various efforts to try to really put the brakes on the use of chemical weapons in the world. You remember World War I, they were horrendous weapons, and both sides ended up feeling like this, just, if there's any way we could just not use them anymore, you know. And they ended up doing it. They pretty much held to an agreement to have neither side use them, because they're just so awful. They're so indiscriminate. Anybody can breathe it, and the kinds of symptoms and pain and agony that happens before you die are really awesome. People that live wish they'd died. I mean, it just totally tears out your lungs in some cases, and in others, you know, all kinds of horrible sores appear wherever it touches and so forth. But somehow the world sort of lurched along with a less than complete ban, and finally a ban was negotiated, and the United States was right up to the deadline of when our Senate had to vote for it, and we didn't have the votes. We were a few votes short. And in fact, including the people that had told the talliers that we don't know whether we're going to get all the votes, we were, you know, more than a dozen votes short. And it turned out that one of our senators in Washington State, where the National Office of LPF is located, it was a really key figure. Slade Gorton is conservative, he's never saw a military program he didn't like. If he would vote for it, it would be important not only for his vote, but there would be at least a dozen people that would look very closely at his vote, possibly be swayed or be moved from the middle of the road to the leaning in favor of kind of category. And LPF worked with the Church Council and a few other people. I mean, the number of people that organized the effort could fit around a booth in a diner, once or twice did fit in that space. To make a long story short, we were able to get religious leaders from virtually every denomination to sign on to a sign-on letter. One of the things we know about Slade is that he does listen to the public opinion about things like this, particularly if there aren't huge economic interests involved. And in fact, ironically, the chemical industry was on our side, because it would open up some markets that were closed to them because of dual use of certain chemicals and a few other related issues. So we really had a chance on this one, and we pulled out all the stops. We just worked really hard to get a very, very broad spectrum of leaders. In fact, the largest single sign-on letter of this kind in the country was sort of cooked up and organized and bottled and delivered by a small handful of us who wanted to do our best to try to make it happen. And all the way along, you know, there were all of the feelings of, oh, this, what difference can we make? Will he really pay attention to this, et cetera, et cetera? It happened the Lutheran bishop, one of the Lutheran bishops in the state, signed on very early and was very important in helping bring on some of the other leaders who were more reluctant to get involved in a political issue like this. Make a long story short, more than 50 prominent, really well-known kind of names signed onto it, and of course it represented several score of other people at lower levels who would be appealing to them to get involved. And in the end, he did vote for it, he did bring along other votes, and it won. And it won by a small enough margin that we could very well have made the difference. And the elements of that success are, first of all, a little bit of an understanding of the process, more than a little bit of information about where we could best focus our energy, a lot of hard work and sort of the grunt level of just getting those envelopes licked and out to people and making the follow-up calls, and crafting a letter that was both very explicit and clear-cut but didn't look too long or too complicated or leave too many loopholes for people to feel nervous about, and then following through every step of the way to try to make sure that it would be clear that if he didn't sign, that he would be disappointing larger numbers of people than simply the signers, that these were people that were representing significant constituencies. And almost a textbook example of people acting on their faith, coming to a conclusion, and one that was pretty clear-cut, but you know, a little humility goes a long way in social justice work. I mean, we've been wrong on enough things in the past that you don't assume that you're right just because it, sort of in a knee-jerk fashion, it looks like a good thing. You really owe it to yourself and to your constituency and to the people, in this case leadership, that you're appealing to have your facts straight. And fortunately, a number of us had worked on it for years, and it ended up being really quite a successful endeavor, and one that you'll never know for sure, but could very well have been part of changing history, of having the United States involved in a really important international treaty where our absence would have made a real big difference in the effectiveness of its implementation and the ability to really isolate states that hadn't signed, the very few that didn't sign, Libya-type states. You want to have the full weight of the international community on the other side of the fence. So if they ever use chemical weapons in a conflict, you can act effectively. So I thought I would start with a fairly political one in the sense of the kind of traditional politics, to say that we live in a really interesting moment in history. Some people think there's less interest in peace today. In fact, we live in an astonishingly fruitful, hopeful moment in history. Things we only dreamed about, like the chemical weapons ban or the comprehensive test ban, which is coming up now in the next few months, we can actually win on. We can get them passed. A lot of the Cold War barriers are down, or issues that were manipulated or redefined or marginalized because of the Cold War are able to be addressed now in their own right. Ethnic conflicts that were left to, well, which side is on the side of this given people, the Soviets or the United States? And if, you know, it was a sort of a lose-lose situation for a lot of indigenous peoples like the Kurds or the Eritreans or others around the world. And now there's the opportunity to put energy into solving these problems in a way that we really haven't seen in my lifetime. So it's a very, very exciting time to act in those kinds of traditional political structure kinds of ways. Well, the second issue I thought I would look at, or campaign, or effort, or whatever you want to call it, is an even more winding process. It's one that's been we've been working on as LPF for a longer length of time. Wall of Hope is sort of the kind of centerpiece, but it's a whole range of projects and efforts to work with young people about issues of peace and justice, and we'll be doing some activity that came out of this project in a few moments, as well as hearing some of the stories, and I'll pass around some photographs of elements of it. I'll start by just saying part of the issue involved here is a kind of a lifelong and largely disappointing or mixed bag kind of experience of me in reaching young people about the enthusiasm that some of us feel about devoting significant energies in your life to peace and justice issues. I've not always been successful. I feel like I've fallen on my face more than succeeded on it. And this is probably the most successful experience I've had in the last decade on that subject. And maybe the easiest way to share what it means is to just dive into it a little bit. For example, when I say the name St. Francis, what do you think? Who is St. Francis of Assisi? What is it again? A little louder.
Oh, I was just going to say of Assisi, he's the one that, for the animals and the poor and so forth, he was a benevolent type person.
Yeah, many churches will have a St. Francis Day where young people are invited to bring their pets and have them blessed, you know. Or in rural areas, you know, even farm animals, the animals that kids are growing for their 4-H project or something. What else? Who else is St. Francis? Any other images come to mind?
He's known for the prayer, "Make me an instrument of your peace."
Yes, yes. And some other prayers. That's certainly one of the two or three or four most well-known religious texts in the world, probably. Anything else? That's more or less, I mean, I would add a similar image to yours, the birds landing on his arms. It's sort of what I, for much of my life, thought of St. Francis. And it's not very fair for any human being to be diminished to a single image like that, but for a lot of people, he's been so sugar-coated, diminished to a single dimension of his life that he becomes too removed from life to be of any value. Well, there's a variety of books and resources that would help us get beyond that, but St. Francis and the Foolishness of God has a story about St. Francis. It begins on page 83. I think is just great and ought to be the one that we add to all of the other stories about St. Francis. Because it turns out that he was quite a committed person, so that with the Crusades going on at the time, it wasn't at all surprising that even with his penchant for peace and so forth, that he would want to go on the Crusades to help this effort to allow Christians to again go to the Holy Land and visit the sacred sites, wrest it back away from the control of the infidel. And he had already figured out that, in fact, war had a pretty ugly face in that era. I mean, he'd talked to other people that had been on Crusades, and fairly early on it was clear that there was an awful lot of looting and raping and pillaging and killing that was far beyond what it would be military necessary. So despite the fact that it was considered a holy war, blessed by the church, God wills it was the slogan under which the Crusaders rallied, he, in the words of Saint Bernard, to kill a Muslim is not homicide. He pleaded with the Christian commander, Cardinal Pelagius, to end the fighting, to work out a negotiation with the Sultan about it. And the Cardinal refused, in fact, broke off diplomatic relations, so there wasn't even any communication. So St. Francis and a buddy of his crossed over the lines and got themselves captured and brought to the Sultan's advisors or whatever, and laid out their idea that, hey, why don't we just negotiate this thing? I mean, this is ridiculous, all this bloodshed. It's really corrupting all of us. And he was, of course, and he and his buddy were assumed to be spies, or at least there was great suspicion that they had other ulterior motives. So one way to sort of test that was to beat them to the inch of death and see whether their story held up under that kind of duress. I mean, if they were doing it for someone else, if they were on orders to find out some information or to trick the Sultan, certainly being tortured wouldn't, you would spill the beans and say, yeah, you're right, we're just following orders and so forth. But in fact, they held to their story there, and their presence was so powerful, that their genuine desire for peace, that they were finally brought to the Sultan, and they negotiated, like, what would it take for the fighting to end? What could you give? What would you allow, for example, free travel to all of the holy sites, like Bethlehem and Jerusalem and so forth? And in fact, the Sultan was willing to negotiate all of those demands, all of the reasons why people were told, we've got to go fight the infidel. And so they're released, they go back to the cardinal, and the cardinal and his military officers refuse to buy it. Part of it is, I mean, that'll be the end of the looting, and but also the end of their crusade, their personal quest. And as it happens in the end, through fighting for many, many more years and tens of thousands of more deaths, they were able to achieve no more than what St. Francis and his partner were able to get in their little shuttle diplomacy out of the Muslim leadership. And it's kind of an amazing story, isn't it? I mean, who would have thought that his peacemaking was more than just simply being gentle, but it involved a tremendous amount of courage and a tremendous amount of very modern kind of thinking about negotiating conflicts and so forth. I mean, Gandhi if he had known the story, could very well have learned something earlier on than he did from Tolstoy or Thoreau or other people in the history of nonviolence. Well, that kind of story seemed to be the way to reach young people. I mean, the stories of the victories of peace and justice. And the distressing thing was that universally, almost, 90% of the dozens and dozens of high school classes and youth groups that we were going into, doing various kinds of experiments and presenting various kinds of things that we were learning, very rarely, literally, 9 out of 10 times, people in the classroom had not a clue. The teachers didn't. The textbooks didn't talk about positive things. By and large, textbooks are of the kind that you expect before King George was booted out of bed by the news that the colonies in the Americas were revolting. I mean, the textbooks are really history from above. Look at it, any textbook that kids study in school, and by and large, it's a story of kings and generals and presidents and maybe a few, you know, if it's really hip, rock stars, you know, or kind of cultural icons of one kind or another. Very little of it is the history of the people who ultimately really do the work. You know, Lincoln led people into the Civil War or through the Civil War, but he didn't fight it. I mean, so part of it was the problem in just the way we've conceptualized the teaching of our culture to young people. And as things developed, developed in both a kind of a story form, but also the project developed in the fashion of a visual form called the Wall of Hope, which is a physical display, if you will. And I'm going to pass some pictures around, that most of these have two or three photographs from the Wall of Hope. Each one of these pages is different, so it's probably pays to look at several. We've installed them in a lot of different formats as well. Here's probably the next. So these are four completely different sets of pictures to give you an idea. They're colored. Cards that are, in this stage of development, all laminated in four different colors, large enough to read from 12 or 15 feet away, so if there's two or three people in front of you, and it's hanging up a little above head height, really large numbers of people can look at it. The last installation, we had 2,800 people see it in a day at this youth gathering in New Orleans. We worked hard to reduce the information to a single sentence or two sentences or three sentences, and so that it includes about 100 of those events. Color-coded, the blues are peace, the orange are racial justice, the red are international freedom movements, the liberation movements, like the American independence moment, and then finally green for social justice sorts of things. About equal number of each one of them. We worked hard to try to get some balance, different countries of the world, different continents, and so forth. And it celebrates the heroes and the movements that actually create history. Underneath each of those cards, then they're all in a row, as you can see from the photographs, are photographs that would illustrate those moments. And some of them had three or four or five or six photographs, others fewer, and we'll take a look at some of them in a little bit. But what I thought I would do is start with an exercise for you to look through. Maybe we can take the first two pages of it and look through and pick out the three or four moments in the first two pages of the listing that sort of catch your eye, that you find inspiring. And I'll call time in like 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, whatever looks like a reasonable amount of time. And then at that point, we'll do a little sharing of what you came up with one another and with the larger group. Does anyone not have the listing? Looks like this. That's the... Everybody understand what we're doing? You're going to look through this and pick out the three or four or five moments that sort of catch your eye, that you find interesting, that you are inspired by. I'll read a few of them into the microphone for the folks that might be listening to this tape, just to give you an idea what we're looking at. One of my favorites is actually the first. Hebrew midwives in the first recorded act of civil disobedience refused to obey Pharaoh's order to kill male Hebrew babies. And then it goes on to describe the Exodus as an experience of liberation central to both Jewish and Christian understanding of God active in history. And among the other events are Amos being called to be a prophet, Jeremiah and Isaiah and Micah. Jeremiah is a teenager, which is good for the young people to see that it's not just older people that are doing all this stuff. Daniel, Paul and the Apostles, Martin of Tours and St. Francis, Martin Luther, the Quakers and Mennonites and Brethren, historic peace churches, opposing war for conscience sake, and 1644, 11 African American servants in New Amsterdam file a petition for freedom, first recorded legal protest in what Europeans called the New World. Underground Railroad, Henry David Thoreau, the first women's rights conventions in 1848, 2,000 Chinese railroad workers in 1867 stage a week-long strike protesting inhumane and racist conditions. Mm-hmm. Another one of my favorites, 1871, 1,000 women in Paris block cannons and stand between the Prussian and Parisian troops and stop a war. 1873 was the first Mother's Day, and a lot of people don't realize it was a peace holiday proposed by Julia Ward Howe in the wake of the Civil War in the United States. Ida Wells and her anti-lynching campaign, a really interesting story of early civil rights activity of 1891. A lot of people don't realize that
protests against war aren't really brand new. The thousands of people protested the Spanish-American War. Mark Twain was one of the leaders and wrote a number of famous texts that talk about his thinking about that. Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, the war poem, and other works on the folly of war. There's a whole section on the U.S. labor movement that these various nonviolent efforts to secure economic justice and dignity and improved working conditions. Mohandas Gandhi, the NAACP, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Bhajja Khan, that I'll talk about in a little bit. International events like 20,000 silk workers in Shanghai, China in 1923 go on strike demanding a 10-hour day, and of course it makes you wonder how long was their day before their strike. Catholic worker, some interesting things that came out of the Second World War.
People have gotten through the first couple pages or close to it. Why don't we do it this way? Why don't you turn to someone next to you? We'll just go in pairs here.
Maybe the two of you, two, and two. And yeah, you want to just come around over here just for a moment. There,
just share, like, what were the things that caught your eye? What struck you as interesting or remarkable, inspiring? What would you gain some hope for, or what changed your idea of a moment in history by reading what you've read here? Just take a half a minute or so, and then I'll call time and switch, have the other person talk for a few minutes. I'll add a few more of the list while people are sharing their experiences. One that I got from Walter Wink's great book, Engaging the Powers, is a series of stories that people don't know about World War II. 1940 to 45 period, Finland saves all but six of its Jewish citizens from death camps through non-military means. 6,500 of 7,000 Danish Jews escaped to Sweden. Most of the rest are hidden, aided by the people and tips within the German occupation force. You can even depend on help from the other side. A rail worker strike in Holland almost shuts down traffic from November 1944 until liberation in May 1945, despite extreme privation to the people. Some point along, finish the sentence and maybe switch to the other person. Similar resistance in Norway undermines Nazi plans. For example, teachers refuse to teach Nazi propaganda. Romania at first persecutes Jews, then refuses to give up one Jew to the death camps. Thousands of Bulgarians march in demonstrations, hide Jews, and send countless letters protesting anti-Jewish measures. Bishop Carroll threatens to lead civil disobedience and lie down on the tracks in front of the trains. All Bulgarian Jews are saved from Nazi death camps. After the war, German generals admit their complete inability to cope with such nonviolent strategies. So there's even the story that people claim to be prove that nonviolence doesn't work. Actually, the nonviolence was more effective than a lot of the violence. Okay. Finish what sentence you're on. Should we share just a few? What were the events that caught your eye, or that you found inspiring, or new, interesting? Let's share a few. What did you pick out? Yes. Good blog.
The 1871, 1,000 women in Paris block cannons and stand between Prussian and Parisian troops.
Okay. They didn't fight. It was successful. Pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
I mean, it took courage, but it also took some creativity. I mean, I think they knew it was going to work, or at least they had a fair chance. They weren't just going to get shot. And you can just imagine these women just fed up with their husbands and sons getting killed in something that to them just didn't seem worth it. I mean, what lunacy. Others. What else caught your eye?
Well, just this number, this one about Pilate displays emblems of Roman authority in Judea. And I don't know if it's actually described in the Bible, but I've just been reading a book by Paul Meyer, Pontius Pilate.
Yes.
This incident is described. It's a novel, essentially, based on the history of the times and Pontius Pilate. And it's very revealing, I think, because he puts you into the times, and you get a picture of the Roman politics and the Jewish, the Judean politics and all this. And this thing about these symbols was very anathema to the Jews. And, you know, it was, and they just, you know, lay down and prostrated themselves and were willing to be killed by the Roman soldiers. And so Pilate just, well, he said, we couldn't do that. He could just slaughter them out there. Mm-hmm. So he gave up and recanted and removed these emblems, which were offensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a good book.
And yet, the kids are universally astonished at these stories. I mean, there's been very little in their experience that has given them an understanding of power other than the kind of stereotypical power over, you know, the bigger gun that Arnold Schwarzenegger carries than the ones that other people have, you know, the bigger muscles or the you know, the better soldiers, you know, World War II movies and so forth and so on. And the idea that there's other sources of power in the world, perhaps even superior ones, let alone more humane ones, like the power of nonviolent activity, as this story illustrates. Someone else had their hand up. Yes?
I thought the Hebrew midwives was also really cool, because it was a long time ago, and how the woman refusing, like, a higher, like, the top man's orders.
And, I mean, I've worked in the issue of violence both as a social worker in very high crime areas of New York and Oakland, the highest crime precinct in New York City, for whatever it's worth. I was a social worker with elderly people, saw tons and tons of violence. And I'm a Christian, I go to church all the time, and until we prepared this material, I had never thought of that incident as an illustration of nonviolence, let alone the first recorded act of civil disobedience. And it shows that, I mean, even those of us that are in this and, you know, committed to thinking about these questions, it's a stretch to sort of think of our own history in ways that are more than the stereotypical ones. I mean, it really takes an effort to sort of pull together out of the kind of fragmentary way we learn history, or the kind of one-sided way we learn history, to come up with the stories as they really are. Other ones that appeal to you. Let's take two more. Yes?
I'm noticing the absence of anything in the 1860s. You described the warfare as lunacy in the Civil War. I know that Walt Whitman was around and
right.
Some things and worked in the hospitals.
Right.
Boy, so much of that was just insanity. And it doesn't seem like there was. I'm not aware, at least in reviewing Ken Burns' theory on the Civil War, of any real big movements.
Right.
Are effective ones
to stop
that.
Oh, there were. I should say that the Wall of Hope has about 500 or 600 moments, and we kind of vote which ones we'll put up on the wall. There's just not room to put everything, and you don't want to overwhelm people. In fact, this what we've got is a little more than what some people can handle. We encourage people to browse. But Walt Whitman would be a good example of someone who was committed to people and ended up volunteering to work in the ambulance corps and work in the field hospitals under just really unbelievable conditions. And there are others. There were people that opposed the war and suffered, you know, from it, or came out of the war with a different perspective and helped educate people about the stories. I actually find Ken Burns' work to be helpful in showing war as something where it's not just glorious, and it's not just that, you know, this assumption that so many war movies or action adventure movies and television shows have, that the good guys are going to win and they're handsomer and they're better and they hardly ever get hit and all of the kind of stereotypes that kids get. Those of you that were in the violence and media discussion last night, they had some very effective footage of what's on the television set night after night, and when you see it all condensed like that, it's really powerful. Mm-hmm. Was there another hand here?
Yeah, the whole civil rights movement, of course, most of them lived through it's just incredible things that were turned around by a few people in this country.
Right.
The little girl, going to school.
Ruby Keeler.
Was the woman recently who was
Rosa Parks.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I've brought along a few of the pictures from the wall, and I thought I would pass them out. We didn't find anything better for St. Francis than one literally with a bird on his shoulder and a rabbit in his arms, but it's kind of a nice picture anyway. We tried to emphasize photos that would include young people in them, so in fact we do have one of the heroes of the civil rights movement that you just mentioned. Okay. Here's a second, Rosa Parks, and I think that's Bates in the other picture. Here's the Freedom Riders, road buses. Of course, famous people like Martin Luther King, as well as lesser known people. Rigoberto Menchu, I would like to believe is well known, or lesser known, the nuns. Giving flowers to the soldiers in the Philippines during the People Power Movement. Or here's one Russian women living in Moldova sitting on the railroad tracks. They look like the Lutheran women who prepare the food for a wedding or a reception at a church or something. They're basically in the 45 to 60 age range, and yet you can just see the expressions on their faces. There's some empowerment that's going on here that is really palpable. Here's one of my favorite photos. Musicians playing in the ruins of one of the libraries, the National Library in the city of Sarajevo. Oscar Romero, Dan and Philip Berrigan burning the draft files. There's a whole series of very touching photos of young people in the before child labor laws, or the four students that sat in at the lunch counter in Greensboro. That wonderful photo, both on a television set and I guess that's a television image of the young man who stood in front of the line of tanks in Tiananmen Square, and then later they would pull back and try to go around him, and he would he was carrying his groceries, or a shopping bag, and he would just move over and then stand there, and just a marvelous image of nonviolent protest and resistance, and just putting all of the onus on the tank commander. What is he going to do? Or here's a unknown Serbian woman in Belgrade protesting this conscription of her sons into the army, saying, why are you going to take my sons from me? And then finally, picture of Dietrich Bonhoeffer with one of his confirmation classes when he's 24 or 25 or 26 years old. And the single most cited incident of the whole wall by the young people. Time and again, we've used this in perhaps 15 conferences and events and workshops with young people, ranging from a few dozen to hundreds to 35,000. The White Rose Movement. Nobody has ever heard of it, and there are just numerous kids who just are astonished at what happened. Here are these kids who are the equivalent of the upper levels of high school or the beginning years of college, who, and just, you look at their pictures. I mean, these are not old people, transparently. And you can see German uniforms on several of them, but it was really hard to go to be able to get into like medical school or something like that without being a part of the brown shirts, just in order to keep any barriers from getting in your way to your occupation. And yet, these kids, just in their reading of classic Christian and literary texts, came to the conclusion that Hitler was really not a good thing for Germany, and in the early 40s began printing up leaflets that they would pass out to their friends. And being more ambitious than I was, maybe at that age anyway, they didn't just print like 15 or 20 of them. And this is before Xerox machines or, you know, a lot of other kind of equipment. They used mimeograph, I guess, and would run off like 3,000 or 4,000 at a time. And very articulate statements that they would pass out to their friends and mail to other people that they would get addresses for. And then finally, in the end, it was 6,000 or 7,000 at a time. And there was one moment where one of the kids, in frustration, just threw them off the balcony of one of the big high schools and got arrested. And ultimately, most of the leaders were arrested and imprisoned and killed by the Nazis. But kids have never heard of that kind of resistance. I mean, the assumption is that the Germans were all just docile, and the few protests were older people who didn't have as much to lose or who had positions where they felt they had to say something, and it's just not true at all. There were lots and lots of small and large protests in all of the occupied territories and in all of the areas where the, you know, the Nazi empire existed. So and there are all kinds of activities that are related to it, and one of them is the keychains. The very first activity actually is just for kids to share like what they're viewing, what catches your eye. Another is what are your heroes? Who are your heroes? Particularly in the early part of the wall, it was found that it was sort of so ancient history that it helped to sort of, after a little bit, pull out of that kind of old period and just think of like, who are the people that you admire? And in New Orleans, there was a big place for the kids to write those names. And we had literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of names written on sheets of paper. And then it would be flipped up and another sheet made available for writing. Page after page of these very large sheets of paper. And then as kids got further around the wall, the other questions asked, who would you add to the wall? Is there someone that you've thought of that would be interesting to include in the wall? What are the qualities of the people that you admire? Was an exercise that ended with, in small group discussion with young people, and ended with them writing on these little keys so that they could, as they got their keys out to open the door, coming home from school, their parents are at work, the sort of bright colored laminated material would kind of remind them of people who in many cases young age, pushed beyond the kind of selfish interests that the media so easily leaves young people isolated in, and thinking about what they could be doing with their lives that would have more meaning than the kinds of pursuits that are so often highlighted. I mean, there's a kind of a extended infancy that's given to a lot of young people by our culture, where they're not respected for their opinions about what's happening in the world, so it's no big surprise that they're not very interested in it. They have tremendous physical capabilities, but it's really kind of the exception that a church will have young people spend a day helping, or a weekend or a week in the summer, helping build a Habitat for Humanity house, or cleaning up a polluted area, or picking up paper along a park, or all of the other kinds of activities. I mean, there's more of that now, certainly, but there could be a lot more. I mean, young people have tremendous reservoirs of idealism and energy that could be channeled in ways that would both make genuine contributions in a world where there isn't enough money to pay people to do all that needs to be done, and at the same time would strengthen their identity as people who can make a difference, and make it much more likely that as voters they would think that it's possible to make a difference. I mean, the level, the cynicism and the sense of hopelessness among young people is thick enough to cut with a butter knife. And any of you that work with young people know what I'm talking about. I mean, it really is a challenge sometimes to break through that. And yet, it will just totally surprise you and flower in ways that you just can't imagine. If you just believe the kind of face that young people often present. And I'm talking about experiences with gang members, you know, who end up like working for the guardian angels, you know, protecting people instead of assaulting them. And they know all of the ways that it happens, and they know all of the kind of ego trips that kids get into, so that they can intervene in ways that are much more effective. And so the potential of not just this activity, I mean, I think this has a certain place in the whole scheme of things, but activities like this that can help inspire young people to see a bigger world and a bigger role for them in that world is one of the places that I've found really, really exciting. I'm going to skip over the next one. This Wall of Hope was preceded by a project that originally was called the Curriculum on Violence and Conflict Resolution, and later we're now calling it the Resource Project on Nonviolence and Conflict Resolution for Young People, because it's broadened so much. We're working as many times with teachers or parents as with the kids nowadays, and we've figured out enough of what works in the classroom. Many of us have spent years working with middle school and high school kids, so that we're not starting from scratch on this. It's really been a lot of fun and a really quite interesting project to figure out, like, what could fit into the existing curriculum in a way that would be useful or inspiring or helpful or help move young people from what oftentimes is a pretty violence-ridden world that they live in, and to see themselves as actors and not just spectators or victims of the violence in our world. So this is, in some ways, what you have is sort of the foundation stone, or the starting point for the activities like the Wall of Hope. I'll say one more thing about the keys, because all of our efforts, I mean, we're not arrogant enough to think that we've got it all figured out. And just about everything we do, we're kind of watching, like, how does it respond, how do kids respond, and what can we do differently. And one of the things that I noticed is that the guys would tend to write strong words on the key, like courage, they would be struck by on the wall. And the women would typically be writing things like compassion. So at one point, I just sort of noted that. And I said, I have an idea. Why don't each of us, male and female, write something on each side of the key? There's two sides to it. Why don't on one side you write something that reflects your sort of male side, and on the other side of the key you write something that reflects the softer or the gentler or whatever side, you know, sort of yin and yang maybe or something. And it wasn't universal, but it was, a number of kids said, you know, that's good, because I mean, why should I play soccer in my school, and I'm better than most of the guys. I have to be a little careful if I want to, you know, have a friendship to, you know, notice who I'm zooming past and scoring a goal on. But in any event, we should be able to develop and notice all of our different capabilities and not be isolated in just one compartment of who we are. And I could tell lots of other stories about it. I mean, there was just a really marvelous wealth of ways in which, just incredible variety of ways in which young people responded to the Wall of Hope and to the activities that followed. Because from there were like 20 different stations and rooms that were created out of the big things that you saw on those photographs. That, for example, I'll pass around a couple of them. On this side is the landmines simulation game. We had a room almost the size of this room here, with a village all painted on canvas and potted plants that we sort of borrowed from other parts of the hotel we were in, and young people could take a look at what it felt like to be in a village, walking along and having a mind blow up. And whenever that happened, everybody in the room would scream at the top of their lungs in that corner of the exhibit hall. Now, this is a 240 by 98 foot room that we were in, all divided up into activity areas. And it was pretty dramatic. The kids all wanted to know what was going on over there and were eager to find out. We also had a series of the sort of dove shapes where kids would vote with little dots on what were their peace concerns. There was another exhibit of Lutheran peacemakers in the last 45 years, 16 different people, Mary Schramm and Bonnie Block and, I can't remember some of the other names, but anyway, wonderful, wonderful people throughout history. Who else is on there? Yes. One of them has Al Bosselman is on there. He's a wonderful guy. He served in World War II and is a combat veteran and wrote a wonderful article called Military Training in the Mind of Christ just shortly before I joined the staff of LPF. I thought I would conclude with a couple upcoming activities. Lutheran Peace Fellowship, for example, is doing a trip to Latin America. The bottom half of the travel opportunity side of this sheet describes adventure that we're going to do this next summer. The idea is to have at least half of the people be young people. We have all kinds of ideas and resources to help them, like raise the money for it. Very few young people have that kind of resource. But from their congregation and their synod and by doing car washes and other kinds of activities to be able to be a part of a trip that would include meeting with young people who are active in peace and justice activities in El Salvador or Nicaragua, and in turn to share their experience and ideas, two-way street. And of course, it'll be open to people of all ages. And you yourself might consider going, but at the very least, I hope you'll share this with people back home who might be interested, a youth coordinator or whatever. There's enough time between now and then that it's entirely feasible to raise the money without breaking anybody's budget. And my personal experience is that I'm just astonished. If you talk to people who are leaders on a synod level or in a congregation or in a region or in a secular peace and justice group like Bread for the World or Peace Action, how many of them have had and would cite as an important part of their development an experience in a third world country for a couple weeks or a month or a semester or a year? And the backside of it talks about academic kinds of programs that do that. The last thing that I think I'll share, we'll talk about the Nobel Laureate's appeal tonight at the forum. If anybody is not going to be there, I would be happy to give you a copy of it. Easily the most exciting new program on the international level that I've seen in a long time. I'm really thrilled about it. I mean, Mother Teresa signed it shortly before she died, and the reputation is that she almost never signs anything. Well, the final thing that I'm passing out now is this New York Times ad, Fellowship of Reconciliation, Pax Christi, Lutheran Peace Fellowship. A whole lot of the peace and justice groups have collaborated to pay the enormous amount of money that it takes to take out a full page ad in the New York Times. And this will be published in a couple weeks. This will be the top, like, third of the page, this text that you have in front of you. And then below that will be some 1,500 individuals and several hundred organizations that have signed on to this. It's really kind of preposterous that resources in our culture are distributed the way they are. In fact, most people are surprised or think that we're fudging the figures to have a bar chart that shows military spending or defense spending being 10 times larger than almost any other single budget line in the budget. The expression that I've used is that we use yardsticks to measure military spending and inch sticks to measure social programs. I mean, there's literally a separate measurement unit of a different order of magnitude between the two. There's numerous military figures. The former head of the CIA from a Republican and from a Democratic administration, and numerous retired generals and admirals who have been at the top position in defining what are our military needs have been speaking out lately to say this is right. I mean, this isn't just woolly-eyed, woolly-eared, woolly-brained peacenicks who don't really understand our defense needs. I mean, this is supported by people that have done the numbers about what we need to defend our country adequately, and they will say, you know, what happens is the same thing that would happen if it was a governmental agency, the AT&T or anything else. When you have a bureaucracy the size of some of the elements of the military, they will want to defend their turf against other departments within the Army or the Navy or the Air Force, but also between the services, and then finally between what they spend their money on and what we spend on education or healthcare or whatever. And I mean, Eisenhower, the only really top military leader who's been president in the last half century or more, you know, that fairly well-known quote that leads the piece off, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. Something eerily biblical about that, isn't it? And in fact, that proved to accurate in the present time as well. And European countries can't believe that we're not cutting back the military more than we are. In fact, they're laughing all the way through the bank. I mean, because the resources that are put into that are not available to help support the kinds of things that would enhance our position in trade and so forth. So there isn't an infinite amount of money in our budget, and it's, you know, all appearances, there's less now than there used to be, and so there's really a lot of reason to consider rethinking what we're doing with it.
What has happened to the Peace Corps?
Well, it still goes along, and I mean, for all of the ways that, you know, it's been used, you know, for purposes that are less than totally savory. I mean, there have been instances where, given countries, it's been used to sort of shore up one or another faction within the country rather than stepping back and thinking, what are the most important needs here and so forth. But I think the Peace Corps is still a marvelous enterprise. And returned Peace Corps volunteers, I think, are really important resources in communities to provide that kind of in-depth experience in another culture. And of course, there's many alternatives to the Peace Corps for people to have year and two and so long experiences in other countries helping. So it's not even the only model, and there's some other models that have some advantages even in the way they're structured and how they serve people. But I'm really in favor of activities like that give people in-depth experience, particularly if they're working alongside of, rather than sort of telling other people what to do. They're sharing resources that we might have in our country. As often as not, people come back and say, you know, they learned as much as I did, they're rather lucky because I went there thinking I was mainly going to serve, and I found that I was the one that was getting served. It just was a different type of experience than I expected. Yeah.
Surprised to read in the New York Times that Greenpeace is in trouble. Can you elaborate on that? They're cutting back, about 60% of their staff.
Significantly,
The money is not coming in. Is it the political thing happening in their organization?
I don't really have much idea of that. I mean, part of it is certainly that the environmental movement has matured to a point where some of the functions that it played aren't as dramatically perceived as dramatically needed. Similarly, I mean, the large peace organizations at the end of the Cold War, you know, suffered significant drops because there wasn't a sense of threat. And many of them have rebuilt along the lines of, like, handgun violence in the schools. Peace Action was mainly known for its international work in the 80s and now is one of the leaders in dealing with handgun violence in our communities and schools and so forth. Fellowship of Reconciliation has a large project on workers' rights in the South in like the chicken processing industry, or I could give other examples if you're interested. Or issues like landmines or the arms trade, or now this Nobel Laureates Initiative, are the kinds of things that are helping sort of the traditional peace groups say, you know, there is a very important function that still needs to be played, along the lines of what I started with the chemical weapons ban. I mean, we had this, a number of the people that we spoke to, we had to sort of get off the dime, you know, to nudge to think that there was anything that needed to be done anymore, you know, or that could be done. And once they understood the issue, they said, sure, yeah, this looks great, count me in. So I think that's part of it. But there's undoubtedly more, I just don't know it, or don't know enough to feel, you know, responsible to talk about it. So. Other comments or questions? Activities that you've done or that you've heard of in your area or in your people that you know that have been involved in inspiring or encouraging ways to either teach or involve people in peacemaking? Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Who are the young people's heroes nowadays?
Very, very wide ranging. The one that was added the most in the groups that I led was Madonna. Mm-hmm. And Madonna. And she's never been a big hero of mine, I have to confess. But I mean, she, a certain amount of brashness, a certain amount of like putting herself out. I think, you know, for whatever you want to say, whether you like the music or not, she has there's a kind of an athleticism and energy that she puts into it that's really remarkable and notable. Yeah, I don't know. I'm a terrible person to ask about Madonna. Those are a few thoughts I had about it. But, you know, I didn't dismiss it. I mean, in fact, that's the last thing you want to do with young people. You want to listen. You know, it may not be the same person that they'll say, you know, a few hours or weeks later, if you listen, if you give them the kind of respect that we would expect for our opinions. But it was very, very, it was very wide-ranging. I mean, a lot of relatives and friends, and when they would tell the story about it, there were some interesting stories. really heroic kinds of things in a, on a, perhaps a smaller scale, but no less important. Mother Teresa and Princess Diana, lots and lots of names.